Right now, watching this enormous development of the computers, I mean, people probably have this fear. It's very deep still, but it's a fear. Who knows? Probably in the future, computer will replace us. I mean, we'll control our life.
You're listening to the voice there of Garry Kasparov, the Russian chess grandmaster who was beaten by a computer called Deep Blue back in 1997. Now, Kasparov was the best chess player in the world at the time, and his defeat got popular culture and the news media wondering if maybe machines were getting a little bit too advanced. But it was a different story for computer scientists who love seeing what technology is capable of. Now, recently, Google developed a new computer designed to play a game that's way more complicated than chess, if you can believe it. It's an ancient Chinese game called Go. And today, Google's Go-playing program, known as AlphaGo, defeated world champion Lee Sedol in the first of five scheduled matches in Seoul. Andrew Keen is with me. He's an entrepreneur and author of The Internet is Not the Answer. Andrew Keen, welcome.
Hello.
You're not here as our resident Go expert, but what do you think is at stake here in this sort of latest round of pop culture man versus machine showdowns, aside from the publicity and the fun of it?
I have to say I slightly disagree with your introduction. I don't think we should think of it in terms of man versus machine, because I think in the long run it's not going to be Kasparov or Deep Blue. It's not going to be this world champion Go player Lee Sedol or AlphaGo. It's going to be a combination of them both. The man and machine is the killer app in the future.
What's at stake?
What's at stake, I think, is average. The people who used to play chess pretty well, the average Go players, and more broadly, I'm not so much worried about professional Go players or chess players. I'm worried about teachers, lawyers, accountants, engineers, journalists like yourself, writers like myself. The real problem with this highly disruptive human-computer partnership is that most of us, unfortunately, I think in the long run, will have nothing to do. We're going to be out of a job.
Now, that's a different vision than sort of the pop culture vision of dominant robots, which, as we all know, is the robot apocalypse. It's Terminator. It's computers taking over our lives. Not only are we irrelevant, but we're oppressed. That's science fiction. But what you're talking about in many ways is much, much more insidious.
Yeah, and it's real. What you talk about as pop culture, it's great for movies. You know, I go with my daughter to these movies and we always imagine the apocalypse, but it's not real. This stuff is real. Google's developing it. Google is the largest company in the world. Google now is wanting to be the dominant player in this new AI, intelligent machine, smart machine space. This stuff is more than just being on the horizon. It's about to change everything.
So some of the artificial intelligence experts, or at least some of the people that cover them that we've talked to recently, have said, and I'm simplifying it, look, there's nothing really to worry about. All these examples that you see, computers can do amazing things, but they can basically do one amazing thing. They are kind of narrow in their abilities, whereas humans are so complex and multifactorial, and machines are nowhere close to being able to process and react and see and operate in the world the way a person is. Really, you guys are just panicking about something that's really nothing.
I think that's wrong. I mean, I think at the moment computers couldn't do what we're doing, which is having an intelligent, complex, nuanced conversation. If you'd invited Siri onto the show, it would have been a farce. But I think in the not too distant future, even that can be achieved. The issue again is that we are creating smart machines that can do most of what we do as human beings, particularly in terms of our labor. Excusing the pun, we're making ourselves redundant.
There has always been a sort of a warning and a criticism that technology marches on despite warnings. There is no stopping it. Are there incentives? Certainly, I wouldn't think laws, aside from having conversations like this and warning people about what we're creating, what else can be done?
An enormous amount can be done. Imagine if we were having this conversation in the middle of the 19th century and you'd have said the same thing about industrialization. and factories employing kids and factories destroying the environment of cities. A huge amount has been done over the last 200 years to harness the most destructive elements of the Industrial Revolution. We need to do the same today about this second machine age, the fourth Industrial Revolution, the AI revolution. There is no single magic bullet. Regulation plays a role. Responsible entrepreneurs play a role. Innovation plays a role. Education plays a role. But we have to acknowledge that this is one of the most profound issues confronting us, not only at the beginning of the 21st century, but in our history as a species.
So as humans are watching the Go news from Korea over the next couple of days in this match between the world Go champion and the machine, how do you want them to be thinking about this?
Think, on the one hand, it's entirely irrelevant, but imagine the creation of an algorithm that replicates yourself, that makes you redundant. You're not a Go player, but if you're a teacher, an engineer, an accountant, a lawyer, a driver, we have intelligent machines, or we're in the business of building intelligent machines, particularly in Silicon Valley, that is going to make you redundant. What are you going to do all day? What does that mean in political terms, in cultural terms, and above all else, from a species point of view, in existential terms?
Andrew Keen, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Andrew Keen is an entrepreneur and author of The Internet is Not the Answer. Tonight, he's participating in a debate for Intelligence Squared US about artificial intelligence. Now, we've been talking all this hour about changing neighborhoods and gentrification. Have you seen your community change? From New York, New York, we got this. My neighborhood is gentrifying and it's very unpleasant. I was part of the creative class wave that stabilized the area, but we certainly didn't push anyone out. Now that there is so much development, it is becoming increasingly newcomer-centric and insufferable. I'm thinking of selling and moving.
My name is Michael. I moved to my neighborhood of Bloomfield, New Jersey in 2007 because the rent was low and the schools were good. The neighborhood is gentrifying, or I like to say upscaling, now, and I'm thrilled.
We got this from Acushnet, Massachusetts. My neighborhood began to gentrify about 15 years ago, and we welcomed it. Property values went up, and most importantly, as most people moved in, the crime went down significantly. We want to hear your story from your community. Tell us at 8778-MY-TAKE. There's much more at the website at thetakeaway.org.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.